This is the Mojo, the Meaning of Life and Business podcast, where life and business intersect. Hosted by Jennifer Glass, CEO of Business Growth Strategies International and BGSI Coaching. We are dedicated to your success. Hello and welcome to another episode of Mojo, the Meaning of Life and Business. Very often, one of the things that we think about when we are looking at what it is that we do in business is we look at self-development. We look at how exactly are we doing something that is going to be making a difference about where we are in our business, what it is that we're trying to do, where we're trying to go, where we're heading, and all of that. Sometimes we invest in programs, sometimes we invest in books, we invest in coaches and mentors, we invest in services. There's a whole lot that we can be doing. And other times we also look internally and we share what we did in books. We share how we helped other people in books. As an example, in my books, I talk about some of the things that we have done to help our clients. My guest today is going to help us learn a little bit more, though, in terms of self-development, how his own book and the process that he is going through right now can really be making a significant impact. And I will share with you some of the stories he was just telling me in the green room are really going to be quite interesting for you as well as you're listening. But before I bring my guest on, let me tell you a little bit about him. Tony Van de Kerkhoff left home at 19 to work and live in China for 4 years. And upon migrating back to Australia in 2012, Tony has spent 12 years working in finance, the last 8 of which have been spent running and growing his finance brokering business. G'day, Tony.
Oh, g'day. We're using the local lingo.
I got to do it for my Aussie friends, right?
That sounds so much better when you say it.
As long as it's not, you know, from the land down under. Now I got that song stuck in my head.
It's a very, very easy to get stuck in your song type, stuck in your head type song. Yeah.
It very much is. It's one of those earworms that once it's in there, I got to think of a Disney song and just push it out. But anyway, so Tony, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. Thank you. So Tony, tell me more about who you are. I mean, I kind of mentioned that you were in China for 4 years. You moved back to Australia and you've been going through a couple of things in terms of your own finance business. Tell me more though, who you are, please.
Jen, look, I'm a dad. I'm a gamer. I'm an avid reader. I'm a gym junkie. I'm a boss to some, a leader to some, and a colleague to many. Really, who I am is, I guess, the summation of who I'm choosing to be every day. I think some days I'm grumpy. Some days I'm happy. I'd like to think I'm happy more often than the days that I'm grumpy. But I'd like to think of myself as the type of person where people think I have time manipulation powers because of the amount that I get done in every single day. And that's sort of, I guess, a point of pride for me. I know there's a pushback against busy culture or really hardworking culture, but growing up in a house with our ethnic parents where it was a case of, you know, you work hard to make a living and to establish yourself, you know, as a first generation migrant, that's, I guess, part of our DNA in our family is to work hard and make the most out of every day.
Absolutely. Thank you. And I'm curious to know, what kind of games do you like to play?
At the moment you're going to laugh because it's the bandwagon game that everyone's playing at the moment. Helldivers 2. Spreading democracy. Managed democracy.
Got it. I live through what my son tells me he's playing. That's how I know, you know, some of the games. But I don't think he's playing that yet. But yes, thank you. So I want to talk about Boss to Some leader to some, colleague to many. I like it, first of all, how you put that. Tell me more. What do you look at? How do you measure yourself as a leader? And where did you learn those kinds of leadership traits in terms of being a boss and a leader?
Yeah, look, that's a great question. I think one of the things I found in life is that you can pull out an image from the negative as well as the positive image. We did photography class in high school. And so before you see what the image, you know, forms into, you see the negative of that. And I think a lot of the time people fail to take the learnings from what a bad leader is, what a bad boss is, and then find the inverse of that. So if you have someone who's domineering, well, then maybe the ideal of a good leader or a good boss is someone who's a little bit more hands-off and gives freedom. So in answer to your question, I would say from experience of having good bosses and bad bosses, I think every situation we put in is an opportunity to learn if we're receptive to it rather than to react. So I've had bad bosses that would just walk in and just do the most ridiculous stuff. And then I've had terrific bosses where you'd almost fall on your sword for these people because of how they made you feel, how they equipped you, how they empowered you, how they were there when you needed help rather than sort of punching down, they lifted you up. You know, it was a series of good leaders and bad leaders that really showed me the difference between the two and how much of an impact that can make on, I guess, someone's day-to-day life. And I think not just in the workforce, but also what they take home.
And that's really important, like you said, what we're taking from the people that we see all around us, we can emulate the good and try and remove or isolate the bad. When we look at ways that we look at everything, I know that a good friend of mine was telling me some of the sharks on Shark Tank, they do different investing programs and seminars around the country here in the US. And yeah. I dragged this friend of mine to one of those events with one of these sharks. And just because I don't want to potentially get into any legal jeopardy here, I'm going to avoid mentioning their name. But when we went there, my friend told me when we came back, he said, look at what this shark did that was good and look at where it made you feel sleazy. You can find ways. And I purposely went to this particular program because I wanted to hear this shark close. And unfortunately, the shark wasn't there themselves. It was someone from their team. However, I did have a chance to meet this shark at a different time, at a different event where this shark teamed up with another major celebrity. Again, cannot say who because don't want to give anything away about the shark. So as it relates though to looking at it in that regard, it's so right. I mean, you take the positive, who you want to emulate, how you want to emulate, and then you make it your own. And knowing where you can put the parts that make you uncomfortable, put those off to the side. So if you're looking at it, Tony, though, and you got that, and like you said, your photography class showed you how you can use the negative to really see what the image was going to be like. Was there anything, though, that really stuck out to you? I'm really curious because leaders very often, they're certainly mentored and other leaders kind of get thrown into it and they figure it out by, you know, the firing range. I'm curious.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. How did you, like your first leadership experience, was it more someone was mentoring you in that regard or was it trial by fire?
I think it was a bit of both because my first leadership experience, I was asked to look after a team of bankers that had just joined and started doing lending at the National Australia Bank. And so I was asked to sort of manage this team in their first 2 weeks to help them understand systems and processes. So that was, I guess, trial by fire. But at the same time, there was really a strong group of competent leaders around me that, because of their leadership, so two levels up, that's the culture that filtered down, was we're all here together. And one of the best sayings, and that person eventually became something of a mentor to me. He used to always say, it's not a party unless we're all on the dance floor. If you see someone on the side of the party struggling, like, pull them in, help them out, make them feel confident, help them get their feet. So I really felt that even though no one was directly assigned to mentor me per se, the group of people around were very open with offering advice and information and, I guess, methods of potentially handling things. So I felt supported and equipped in that sense. From that, I was blessed enough that at that time, my leader's leader left that part of the business to go work in another part of the business, he actually reached out and said, you're coming with me. So I followed him into the next role and was enabled by being coached by him one-on-one. So he was very big on coaching. He was a former amateur boxer. So, and he's in management at a large financial institution. If you can imagine, he had a really interesting upbringing, tattoos on his knuckles, up his neck, you know, used to be probably from one of the shadier parts of town doing the shadier things. But someone at the bank long ago gave him an opportunity, and he grabbed that with both hands to really transform and turn around his life. And so, and he uses, you know, boxing at the gym that he now owns as well to do that for youth in the community and to help them, you know, use the discipline of boxing to turn their lives around. And so for him, coaching was a massive thing. So it's really hard for me to say that I was mentored, because I feel like I was more coached. Mentoring is for me, and I could be wrong about the definition, but what it means to me is someone who's a bit more hands-off, gives you advice when you need it, but isn't necessarily there following up with you one-on-one. At the time, my leader, he would coach, you know, weekly, fortnightly, and just coach on whatever it is you needed help on. And because he hadn't done home loans in a very, very long time, he hadn't written loans in a long time, what he would coach on is people skills, management of, like, you know, difficult situations, and potentially for the role that the bank sort of saw that they had in mind for you. So seeing him in action and then being coached by him really instilled, I guess, the importance of coaching, which, funnily enough, when you go out and start a business, you kind of don't realize, or you forget, that coaching that you received is super necessary for the people that will then follow underneath you when you start a business. And I think when I started the business the first 5 or 6 years, very competent with the lending side of things. But when it came to coaching and looking after my people, there was definitely an element of imposter syndrome, because most of the team was older than me. Most of the team was more experienced than me. Who am I to tell these people how to run their life, right? And so I think there was a process over the last 2 or 3 years, through people leaving and people joining and seeing the type of people that would come and go, where I realized I needed to step up and emulate my old leader a bit more and take a more proactive stance on coaching, and not just on technicalities of the role, but on resilience as a person, on adaptability of someone's mindset, to not just be very rigid in their thinking and expect the world to fall into place around their, you know, ideology. So to take a more higher level and deeper plunge into who they are and coaching around that, and who they want to be and who they think is their ideal self. And that was all just part of trying to create a good work environment. And it turned into a lot more than that, but it took me having to get over, I guess, a sense of imposter syndrome that was holding me back, thinking this is not a topic that I'm qualified to broach in the workplace.
It's so interesting, the imposter syndrome. And there's so many people that get it. I think there's more women, though, that tend to get it than men. But there's definitely a lot there in terms of the imposter syndrome, because, again, like you said, who am I to be telling these people how to live their lives? Many of them being older than you, they may have had many more years in their career than you had up until that point. And also, I like how you also said, though, the idea that when you were taking the coaching that you received with you into that new position, that it was so important. And you see all the time people who had great teachers, great leaders, great bosses, they move into another position, they tend to follow suit. Those that had the opposite also tend to follow suit. And I mean, if you think about the medical industry as an example, and I was just talking about this with my son the other day, where you have doctors who they went through their residency, they went through medical school, and they had to pull 24, 36, 48 hour shifts even just to cover whatever it is that they needed to in the hospital. They do the same thing to their new residents that they are training, because I had to do it, you have to do it. And it's just par for the course, right? We all go through it. We all learn by doing this. You're going to be doing it as well. And so we end up living in that vicious cycle that one begets the perpetuating next, begets the next, right? Perpetuating the bad in that sense. But again, like you said, you came with the information and you were in a much better position. So I'm curious to know, Tony, though, if you surveyed the people that work with you, what do you think their biggest positive about you would be?
Geez, that's a tough one, because I don't like to self-aggrandize, I guess, if that's the way of phrasing it. I think the positive, I would like to think that the positive people would say is that I'm understanding and supportive. I would like to think that people think I'm understanding and supportive, but at the same time, I have high expectations. So it's definitely a twofold thing there, because I don't want to be the nice guy who achieves little. And right. At the same time, I really feel that people are capable of so much. And so I hold people to the same standard I hold myself, which is actually probably a downfall. In some ways, I've needed to lower that expectation on others, not only because it's not their business, it's just their job, but also because I have realized that not everyone is built like me. And that sounds like a really ridiculous thing to say, because obviously, just looking at the screen today, you can see, Jennifer, you and I look very different. But in terms of, you know, what that means person to person, sometimes we transpose our method of thinking, our own, I guess, standards and our own expectations that, oh, surely, or this is what must be the case for everybody. But everyone's built different. Everyone's in a different space. Everyone's had a different path. So understanding that, yes, I have high expectations and I am an understanding person who wants to see everybody perform at their best. Not everyone is at the same level or pace of self-development or professional development in their career. So what would people say? People would say, yes, I've got high standards, but at the same time, I'm always equipping people, or I'm always just passionately caring about how can I make their lives better.
Have you ever asked them how you can improve as a leader?
I have. I've asked my most recent hire, Kim, what can I do better? And I think you would have to go backwards in the people that have worked for me to get that. What can you do better? Because where we're at now, I think we need a bit more time to find what else I can do better, because Kim is currently receiving, you know, 8 years of accumulated trial and error, like learning on how to look after things. So Kim's got probably the best version of it, of that management and leadership and working with us. And I only realized that, I'm not saying that because, you know, I'm just talking, but Kim joined us, and then shortly after she made the comment that it was the least toxic workplace she's ever worked in and the best work environment she's ever been a part of. So that to me was bigger praise than any Google 5-star review from one of our clients. And talking to the point where you coach your people, not just on the technical requirements of a role, like how do you do this? How do you do that? Why am I doing this? Why am I doing that? But also, in order to achieve a better result in this area of your work, you can adopt this mentality, or you can have this method of conflict resolution. Let's dive into that and how we can resolve that. Let's go through some examples how that can help at home and how you can resolve these, you know, misunderstandings at home and the workforce in like a really respectful way. And, you know, without getting into too much detail, Kim told me this story from Christmas. They'd just gone away to Japan and they'd come back and they were sitting around the family dinner table, you know, relatives all around, and her and her partner were having a discussion. And her sister commented, "Have you guys been going to counseling?" And it wasn't, it was the coaching that we've been doing in the workplace about, you know, communication and understanding and this sort of thing that helps at work, but also helps at home. And Kim had a solid laugh because she was like, "No, I've just been having coaching." So that to me is sort of like the barometer, because I find that oftentimes if I put people on the spot, they might feel like they want to be a people pleaser, or they don't want to seem like they're picky. And again, sometimes the feedback you get, depending on the person, can align to maybe what they want more. So for example, they may feel uncomfortable when we're holding everybody to a high standard. So they might say, "Oh, you could relax a little bit on these things." And it's like, well, I'll take that feedback on board and just archive it somewhere. Because sometimes people provide feedback with a bit of selfish bias as well. So,
well, again, I try to just self-reflect through their own colored glasses.
Yeah, that's it. That's it.
Yes.
And I'm not saying I'm perfect by any means, but I usually find the best feedback I get comes via my business partner letting me know, like, "Hey, I heard someone talking, like, you know, this way in the office," or maybe they made comment on that, and it wasn't comment directly against me or about me, but it might have indicated that something I said didn't come across the right way. So, and then I'll immediately step in to clarify in the way that seems appropriate at the time, whether it's in front of the group to make sure that no one else felt that way, or whether it was one-on-one just to make sure that that person knows very clearly that that wasn't felt that way. But I tend to get my feedback from other sources where they're more likely to be fully transparent rather than guarding or feeling like they need to, you know, put their gloves on when they're delivering the feedback.
Absolutely. So, Tony, I want to take a turn and move into talking about the book that you're in the process of finishing. So, yeah. First of all, tell me more about the book. I mean, what is it about? Mm. What kind of information is there? And what can I, as a reader, expect to be gaining as a result of investing my time reading the book?
That's a terrific question. I started this because we were heavily locked down during the COVID and the vid. And I did a lot of reading. So on the shelf behind me, for anyone who's not able to see, there's quite a number of books buried amongst the whiskey and the Lego. There are a significant number of books, and there's more on the bookshelf there, and there's more in the cabinet down there. There was just not much to do except exercise and read. So what I realized was is that there is an absolute gold mine of information out there on how to become a more effective person, not just a better person, but someone who's effective. Unfortunately, some of those books are great, easy reading. Some, you know, they're about as fun as licking the wall. They're not the easiest books to get through. So a good example is, you know, Atomic Habits is a terrific book on how to actually implement the things in your life that you talk about and never get around to doing, and how to make that consistent and sustainable. 7 Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey, all-time classic, OG book. But man, that book is technical and difficult. It is. And then there's Acting Slow, Thinking Fast. I can't remember the order in which it's described, but I got about a chapter into that book before I fell asleep. It's just so technical and psychological. And I understand that the quality and the content is good, but it's only as good as I can digest it. So it might be the best content in the world, but if I can't digest it, or if reading it turns me off reading the rest of the book, then the information's wasted. So I didn't want to just read it for the sake of ticking the box and saying, "Oh yeah, I've read that." So what I thought was, well, I've got 2 boys two sons. One is 13 and a half. The other one's just turned 10. And I thought to myself, how much further or accelerated would my life process have been? How much more could I have achieved, or how much pain could I have mitigated or avoided if I had the knowledge that I do now around, you know, self-awareness, time management, setting goals, all that stuff that they don't teach you in school. You know, you can recite the date of a historical event, but you don't know how to, you know, practice self-awareness and reflect on your own shortcomings and what you can do better, which is wild. That's not taught to people growing up. We have to rely on generational wisdom. We have to rely on the proactiveness of our parents and family members in determining that this is a topic they want to teach, if they even realize it is something they want to teach. So in writing this book, I went, well, I want to create a primer, a handbook, if you will, for young people or people that are just starting a self-development journey. A primer that is easy to read, offers experiences from my own life to sort of ground it a bit in where I found this beneficial to me. And I've offered a few hypothetical scenarios as well that are drawn from, you know, people that I've met in life and have done certain things or not done certain things. So obviously with them, there's anonymity, but for me, I'm quite raw and open about how some of my failings in these areas and then learnings from these areas have hurt and improved my life respectively. So the chapters that it covers, I feel are the biggest chapters, and I'm sure there's books that go into better detail and more effort and are more outlined in terms of focusing on these areas, but you don't know where to start unless you've had that map out for you. So if you were told, let's start traveling, but you didn't have a map of the world, you wouldn't be able to even pick a country. So unless you had some background information on what, even say continent, what did that continent sort of have that was attractive, or what was it about that continent that was interesting, you wouldn't know which one to pick or where to start. You can waste time exploring areas that are of no interest to you because you didn't know what was there or what was to be uncovered. So the sort of eight core areas I focused on, I feel, are the eight areas that every young person, if you read through this, you would be able to go, oh, wow, I never even realized that was the thing. Or, well, I thought, you know, creativity was just painting. Well, I didn't realize leadership can be demonstrated by anybody. Stuff like that, that I really, really want, and with my sons in mind, to read this one day and for them to get that fast track that I didn't have.
It's really important, like you said, to have that leadership, to have that knowledge that is available to help you. I mean, when I wrote Building a Winning Mindset, it was partially for me also, because again, we all run into those issues. How do we really focus on mindset? How do we focus on what is it that we really need to be doing to get somewhere? And it was also for my kids. How can I make sure that they know what they need to do? One of the things I started doing with my daughter about 11, 12 years ago was we decided we're going to make jewelry. It was a nice project for the two of us to do together. And it also allowed her to understand money doesn't grow on trees. You have to earn the money. And it was a way that we really got that. And we used to watch Shark Tank together. And it used to be, okay, now tell me what the company valuation is. Tell me how you figure out what your costs are, what your margins are. And all of that started coming in because of the way that I was raising my children, because I understood that, again, like you said, in school, they don't teach you entrepreneurialism. No. They teach you to get a 9-to-5, 9-to-6, whatever job. And they're not teaching you, though. Sorry?
I was just going to say, you're spot on in regards to what they do and don't teach. My son, you know, like every child, they want that thing that they see in the shop or in the magazine. But this is before COVID, when we were working in an office building that had quite a few other businesses in it. I said to him, I said, well, Jacques, you know, you can do chores for me at home at 50 cents an hour or whatever it was I was going to pay him to do these chores. And that's going to take you a very long time to save, correct or not? And he was like, yeah, that's going to take me forever, Dad. It's almost seems pointless. I just don't even want the thing anymore if I'm going to have to work that much, that hard for that long. And I said, oh, well, then let me teach you about leveraging. And so we took his pocket money that he had. We went to the supermarket. We bought a bunch of, you know, bulk buy cans of soft drink and lollies. We also bought, you know, little plastic baguettes, and we bagged them up. We separated them out, and we worked out what our cost base was. And we said, well, let's work out what's reasonable. So we're selling, we packaged them into smaller bags and then sold them for $2 a bag or whatever it might've been. And he ended up doubling his money. And I said, well, that's now you're learning to leverage. And so he would have his skateboard with a little cardboard box on it. And it was Jacques Lolly Shop. And he would drag that through the office halls, and he'd knock on the door with his cute little face and his school uniform. And he'd go, hey there, just want to make sure you had your lollies for your Friday. We picked our timing because on a Monday, people were less likely to buy the lollies and the chocolates because, you know, after school hours, because, you know, they'd binged on the weekend and they just sort of wanted a break from it. But come Friday, people were keen for their sugar hit. They wanted their chockies. They wanted their chocolates. So, so similar to you, Jen, I really, truly believe in not just, you know, teaching, but then going out into the field and giving it a red hot crack. And the confidence that he built from cold knocking on doors, selling his, you know, grocery wares and stuff was terrific. So it was absolute win-win all around. He doubled his pocket money. He got all this extra confidence from being cute, knocking on doors and just selling to people and providing a service. And he learned about, you know, also market timing as well, understanding right. Your market.
Very useful life skills. And it's really unfortunate that they don't teach that in school. So, Tony, let me ask you, though, as it goes through the book and you were writing the book as a guide to your kids, you were giving it as a guide to other people as they're trying to just figure out what to do, how to do. What were some of the biggest fears as you started writing the book that you were dealing with?
That this is not good enough, that I'm very boring. Is this too boring? Is this like a textbook? And it was, I was right. The fears were actually based on reality. So it wasn't like I was conjuring up these magical demons. No, my book was, you know, initial version was bad. And I got that feedback. I said to my business partner, I said, hey man, can you have a quick read? This is like first couple of chapters. And after it, he goes, is this a textbook? He goes, I'll fall asleep if I read this. And I was like, all right, I'll take that feedback on board. And then the next person I sort of gave it to was one of my clients. He's really into self-development, you know, picture athletic, very successful in his career, ice baths and saunas, right? That's the type of character we're talking about. And reads a lot, listens to a lot of audiobooks, and he read it and he goes, there's nothing about you in here, man. It's like, it's, you know, it's not like a textbook anymore from what you're saying because of the improvements you made, but there's not a shred of your identity in this. There's no stories about you, how you've used these skills. And I was like, okay, also a good point, because I have no idea. I've never written a book before. So I went back and I made those iterations and changes. So a lot of the time, I think our fears are founded. I think a lot of the time our fears are founded, and we need to explore those fears to see whether or not there is any basis to them. But yes, did I have fears? Absolutely. Were a lot of them real, like, you know, actually there? Yes. There were issues that needed to be addressed and solved. But I think no matter what, like even now coming up to the finish line, I feel like this is about as complete as it's going to be. And I still have fears. And I really feel that right up until the day that this comes out on paper, still going to have fears about this thing, because you tie up so much of yourself. And I want to say a part of your identity becomes entwined with it, because, you know, Jen, you would understand, you pour your heart and soul into these things. You really do want, you do this with the intent to have a positive impact on people's lives. And so if you think that if it's not successful, it's not so much like we were talking about this before, like you said, in the green room, I don't care if this makes money or not, but if people don't buy it, it means that they feel that there's not enough value. Or not enough perceived value. So for me, I'm my only fear now is that I haven't put as much value into this as I could. So at the same time, I have to balance that with what's my page count. So it's a really interesting tightrope to walk. But again, the fears that I'm experiencing are just something to acknowledge and I guess work through rather than to stop me from making any further progress.
Absolutely. And I can tell you that my accountability partners were after me so much for getting the book done because I kept on saying, yeah, I'm working on it. And there were times where I definitely got a little more perfectionist than needed to be. But it was also a part that once you put it out there, it's done.
Mm.
And am I really in that position to say, okay, fine, I can do this, I can do that and everything, and I can be okay with it all. And I mean, my partners were telling me, I think it was, what was it? I think they said I was telling them for about 6 weeks at one point, it's going to be this week. And they just started cracking the whip on me and saying, look, just get it done. Because at least once it's done, then it can be something else that I can focus on. And yeah, again, I can put it out there into the universe. It's like birthing another being. It is your business. It is your book. It is whatever it is that you're putting out there to the universe at that time. And you're going through all of these steps because you're trying to give of yourself to people. And when you can share a book, you can share your business, you can share whatever it may be, there's all of those different things that we're going through and all of these different thoughts. And so thank you, Tony, for that perspective, just from your side as well. What I wanted to ask you is, as we move on from the fears of the book, what are you hoping is going to be the biggest impact the readers are going to get when they open up the book?
To be honest, every single chapter has its own element that there's been something really poignant in my life that I've observed or has mattered to me where I've gone, this changed the game for me. And I hope that each chapter has that same impact on someone else, but in a much shorter time frame. So it doesn't take them 15 years to get these core elements. For example, chapter 2, after you get through the first introductory chapter, the very first meaty segment that I want to get people into is self-awareness. Self-awareness is the number one superpower. So when I look at each one of these chapters and I go, you know, if anyone reading this book was just to gain an element of self-awareness, what impact does that make? Does that make them, instead of arcing up and rebutting and getting into an argument with their spouse at home in front of the kids, does that mean they take a deep breath, think back and go, well, maybe I am wrong. Let me reflect on this. I was speaking to one of my ex-high school friends, or high school friends, not ex-friends, but ex-high school. And we were talking about how our generation typically, we're talking about the five whys, when you get asked why by your kids, and how it's actually a really powerful tool for adults to uncover their underlying reasons for doing things. But when I was growing up, if you asked why more than twice, the next answer was BELT, pulling out the belt, you know, like, hey, that's one more why than you're allowed to ask. Crack. Time to duck and run. Whereas I think our generation's more responsive and self-aware, where we go, well, why am I asking my child to do this? Let me reflect. Is it because of my upbringing? Is it because I've got some unconscious bias towards something? So we tend to be more self-aware, but that self-awareness, I've just seen people on the flip side who lack it and the problems it causes for their life. They're on their 10th job in 8 years. It can't be everybody else's fault, you know, and there's this lack of stability that then translates to, you know, them being with a partner that believes in them, that then supports them, then starts to give up, because after a decade of the same nonsense going around in circles, there's just a lack of self-awareness around what their shortcomings are. So for me personally, like, I don't want my boys to grow up with that same lack of self-awareness. That would really hurt me to see them, you know, make the same mistakes over and over and over. So in response to your question, I would hope that there's at least 1, 2, 3 chapters in this book that each person can pull something from. If they've never read a self-development book, it's supposed to be easy reading, that they can pull something from each chapter and go, wow, that really spoke to me, and that's going to make a difference.
You are right on target in terms of how you are trying to look at it. And I mean, one of my coaches told me when I was starting to write the book, transformative, not informative, is the result that he was saying that I should be going for. And so I've tried keeping that in mind. And even at the end of every chapter in my books, I include a action step. And it's usually 2 or 3 questions at the end of each chapter, right? So you learned all about this. How are you going to put it into play in your business? Where are the areas that you can really start making that stand out? Because
absolutely
everything has to be taking action. It's really nice to go out there and say, all right, here's an idea of what to do, but what is it that you're going to actually get by doing this? And that's where that difference comes in. So without a question, yes, and I'm glad at least that you are looking at the book in that regard. So the other idea that I wanted to cover is in terms of looking, let's just say 18, 24 months down the road, where do you hope to be as a result of the book? Or in general, I mean, where are you looking to get?
It's really interesting because purely from the outset, this was something I felt was too emotive and too burned too brightly in my heart to keep it contained. And there was no real thought to what was the end result. How is this going to future impact, or what was going to be the product as a result of this? Now that I'm close to the end, it's funny because now you start to go, well, what is this even going to, beyond the desired impact of changing people's lives, like, what is this going to do? And the book is being launched through a company that I started called Victor Delta Kilo. And to give you an idea of where it's going, I'd love to let you know a little bit where it came from. So Victor Delta Kilo is just my surname, Van der Kerkhoff. It's just the initials for my surname, VDK. My name was horribly long, and no one in the bank who really didn't know me that well ever wanted to say it, so they just called me VDK. Victor Delta Kilo was originally a way that I could explore my passion for whiskey. I've got whiskey under production. And I did it under, I just thought, oh, I'll just call it, you know, VDK, and I'd have the whiskey under this company, because then it's tax deductible. It's a tax saving. It's a business venture. It's not just like a passion project. And the Victor Delta Kilo came from, I just said to myself, well, after COVID, life's too short. I'm going to go get flying lessons. So I was learning to fly, single propeller airplanes, little Cessnas. And I was sitting in the training room, and they had the, I think it's called the aeronautical alphabet, where it's like Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, and it's like how you say all the ABCs. And I was like, oh, I wonder what my initials are. And it was Victor Delta Kilo. And I thought, that sounds pretty cool. So that's how that started. And then I started this whiskey. And then after I did the whiskey, I was like, what do I do with this company now for the next 5 years while I'm waiting for the whiskey? And because I, you know, explored flying as something I wanted to try, and I wanted to make my own whiskey, and I realized Victor Delta Kilo was going to become the vehicle for me to explore my passions in a commercial sense. And then I was reflecting on what it is about financial broking that I love. And it was definitely not the maths, because I'm statistically terrible at maths, But that's why we have software to do that. And what I do is I like solving puzzles. So everyone's situation is a different puzzle. And that's what's kept me so engaged for almost a decade now, is that you get to solve puzzles. So that's great. And it pays the bills very well. But what I love teaching. I was a teacher for 4 years in China before I came back to Australia and started working in the bank. And the most rewarding part of being a finance broker was being able to cross-pollinate what I've learned from other clients and then delivering that sort of by way of just a casual conversation to current clients so they didn't make similar mistakes. And then seeing the transformation and evolution of the way that I coach at the office really brought about a particular joy and fulfillment that you don't get from just writing loans. And I really wanted to explore that. And like we were saying before in the green room, the education piece, I was speaking around the country on how we as a business have used technology and efficient processes to transform the way we do business, to the point where I had written the same amount of loans as I had the year before, but had managed to get halfway through writing this book, developed a course, traveled for almost 2 months of the year, like because the process was so good. And I was having people come up to me after I was presenting saying, they were dying. Like they just felt that they were being crushed by the workload. And it inspired me to create a course that would help brokers improve their businesses. And from there, I was like, wow, this feels terrific. Like, I love this, being able to create content that I can deliver remotely that is going to make their lives better. So these brokers, it's not like, oh, maybe they're making more money, but the majority of them are just being able to make good money and spend more time with their families. Like that was really powerful to me to assist people to explore and have the best version of their current lives. And from there, I realized there was, you know, a gap in Australia around education on finance and property. So I created three courses on that, one for basic money management and then two for basic and advanced finance investment. Very Australia specific, those two, because the Australian lending market is super regulated, so very different to the US one. But again, like it was just a real passion and joy to create these things and see the value they provided. So now that the book has been worked on throughout all this, and similar to you, where it was like, I need to finish this book. And then it was, oh, what about this course? And I'd get sidewinded into creating a course on something. Now that it's coming up to completion, and there's not really many courses, nothing left course-wise on the plate to complete right now, the book's coming up and I'm thinking, how is this going to impact, or how is this going to reflect or impact my future life, or what's it going to do for me? What I've felt up to now has been that it will provide at least some insight to people that I'm not doing this to turn a quick buck. I think the number of people that are creating courses on this or that with very little experience in the matter, a year or two of experience in the matter, and then they really fake it till they make it. So they become famous for the course and not for what they did. I really want people to understand and feel that my passion is not to make money from people, but just to have an out leveraged or a really over leveraged source of value. So they pay X and they go, how am I only paying X for the amount of value that's being delivered, which is Y? Like, that's insane. So if I can create this book and people go, all right, well, what's Victor Delta Killer about? Really, the core philosophy is, and something that I'm very passionate about, is everyone has a God-given right and responsibility to be better, than they were yesterday, to be better than they were last year. And this falls into that category of, well, it's not finance stuff because I've done finance stuff my whole life, but the self-improvement stuff, the three pillars of, you know, health, physical health, mental health, and financial health, that they are the three pillars that form the foundation of Victor Delta Kilo. It's just to be better in these three areas. So yes, the financial part for us Aussies has been pretty covered. The health part, I've got a range of supplements for sale on the website just for, you know, mental acuity and focus. But the mental well-being, aside from the physical health, the mental well-being and the being better mentally, emotionally, that's really what this book is. It forms the third and what I feel is the most important pillar of Victor Delta Kilo. It fleshes it out from, you know, a business that just sells information about finance stuff, property stuff, to a business that is really about trying to improve the lives of everyone in the most significant ways possible.
Thank you. And that's definitely a really good answer. Thank you.
Don't call me Tangent Tony in the office for nothing.
Yes. How can people find out more about you, Tony?
Look, honestly, the best way you can find out is follow me on Instagram if you want to see my day-to-day life. Day-to-day lifestyle, follow me on Instagram. I'm an open book. I really appreciate that because I want people to see the type of person I am and not like a created image. So if you want to know more about me professionally, LinkedIn, absolutely. I'd say these two platforms, professionally LinkedIn. If you want to get to know more about me personally, Instagram for sure.
Thank you. And definitely, what is the name of the book, by the way?
All right. So here we are, the big reveal. Cue drum roll, ladies and gentlemen. The big reveal of the book is You Are Your Biggest Problem. And that's fantastic.
So you're going to want to check out You Are Your Biggest Problem. And that's fantastic. Will be available on Amazon and wherever you get your book. So definitely take a look at that. Reach out to Tony, connect with Tony on Instagram. And that's going to be Instagram.com/AntoniusVDK. Descriptions as well.
Yeah, awesome, guys. And just Antonius, right? So that's it. The Tony stems from Antonius, which is an ancient Latin, it's the original Latin version of Antonio. And only my mum and my boss in China, when I was in trouble, ever called me Antonius. But thanks to Instagram, Facebook verification procedures, they need your full name. I'd love to just have a handle that's Instagram.com/TonyVDK, but I have to go with Antonius. But yeah, Van der Kerkhoff, if you can just search Van der Kerkhoff, there's not that many of us, especially Tony Van der Kerkhoff or Antonius Van der Kerkhoff. So yeah, looking forward to connecting with some people.
And there you go. So make sure that you get the book, connect with Tony on Instagram and LinkedIn. You can also check him out, victordeltakilo.com. For more information, reach out, connect, make sure you get the book and go from there. But don't just get the book. It's all about really taking action. Mm. Everything is not only in the mind. It is, how are we going to put it into action? What are you doing? And that's why I also said the word before, invest my time in the book. It's not just, I am spending my time reading the book. I am investing my time, because we know that time is the only commodity that we can never get more of, the only true commodity. And so when we understand how we invest our time instead of spend our time, we have a much better understanding of where and how we are moving forward. So first of all, Tony, thank you so much for being my guest on the show today.
My pleasure, Jen. And if it's okay, if we can end on a quote by Carl Sandburg.
Sure.
Because your time management one, is a topic I'm particularly passionate about. Carl Sandburg had a quote, which is, time is the coin of your life. It is the only coin you have, and only you can determine how it will be spent. Be careful lest you let others spend it for you.
I don't know how to top that. So I'm going to say, on that note, this has been another episode of Mojo, the Meaning Life and Business. And until next time, here's to your success.
Thanks, Jen.
This has been another episode of Mojo, the Meaning of Life and Business podcast. If you like what you heard, please consider leaving us a review, liking us, or reaching out to us. You can contact us at bgsicoaching.com and let us know what you think. Thanks so much again for listening.